Theodore Teddy Wilson was born in Austin, Texas, November 24th of 1912. I was surprised to learn, too, Teddy, that you didn't play piano exclusively when you were younger. You are a well-rounded musician.
Yeah, I studied the violin, oboe, and clarinet. And
you ever kept up with any of those?
No, I dropped them all when I became a jazz pianist. Uh-huh. So I played piano in the high school dance band and the violin in the chapel orchestra and the oboe and clarinet in the marching band, parade band. We played, you know, the football games and
yes.
The group parades.
It's kind of hard to carry a piano around it, though, isn't it? I don't think I've ever worked harder in getting ready for an interview than I have with you, and you can judge by the stack of records here. We must have a supply of Teddy Wilson records, you with your own orchestra, with other orchestras and groups that stand somewhat taller than me. Do you have any idea of how many records you've made in your career?
No, I don't. There is one of the encyclopedias has a discography of mine, but I never noticed.
It's a staggering amount.
Yeah, many different people and many as a sideman and many as a leader.
When did you begin playing piano? How old were you?
I was 7 years old.
Is that a good time to start, or did you feel it was a little bit early?
Well, I've checked that with classical teachers, and they say that the judge is not to be made from the age, but from the time a little child can concentrate for a half hour.
Did you ever regret having played the piano? Did you ever feel that you wanted to go more seriously, say, with clarinet?
No.
Not at all.
I was more interested in the jazz world.
Uh-huh.
And I was already into piano with the dance band, you see, there.
Who were your models when you were very, very young?
Well, first it would be Fats Waller, then Earl Hines, and then Art Tatum would be my three favorites.
Yeah, gee, you picked three good ones there. But three very...
My playing is sort of a mixture of those three.
Right, it's three very different styles.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Of the three, who would you say had the strongest influence on you?
I'd say maybe Tatum. Mm-hmm. Tatum was the only true phenomenon, I think, that we've ever had in jazz. We've had geniuses, many geniuses, because we lost one of our real giants, Duke Ellington, of course, and Armstrong. I say Armstrong for the solo improvising procedure, and Ellington to put jazz down on paper, with pen and paper, mm-hmm. to write for big group of men, as those two just tower like giants above everyone else. And they've been the biggest influences, I think, around the world with jazz musicians in their respective categories. But Art Tatum was a phenomenon. He was not a... He was like a man who can hit a hole-in-one every time he picks up a golf ball. He was a piano phenomenon. And I don't know whether you even should call him a jazz pianist, because he just had a command of the keyboard that no one has approached yet.
He played a lot of notes.
I don't think any classical players ever... I've ever heard a classical player with that kind of command of the keyboard.
I think you can listen to one of his records, Teddy, over and over and over again before you can ever begin to appreciate everything that went into it. His is music that you can study. What was there about Fats Waller that you adapted to your style? Because he was basically a stride pianist, and I don't hear...
He's the first... See, I grew up in a little school. My parents were school teachers in a boarding school in Tuskegee Institute, Alabama, and it stuck out in the woods. It accommodates about 2,000 students, and my father was head of the English department then. My mother had the unique job of teaching adults who would be on, say, like the second and third grade level. Mm-hmm. And so we had no record stores or anything, but the boarding students who came there during the season, school season, would bring their record players and recordings. And so I got to hear Louis Armstrong's group, King Oliver, Bix Beiderbecke, Frank Trombor, people like that. And I heard a Fats Waller record. I'd never heard of Fats Waller before, so he's the first famous pianist already on RCA Victor doing piano solos back in the 1920s.
You have such a fantastic, busy schedule. I don't see how you keep up with it all, but you manage, thank heaven. As a matter of fact, as I talk to you now, you're in an engagement at the Tobacco Valley Inn, and by the time we get this program on the air, you're going to be due to come back for a return engagement. It'll be awfully nice to have you back in our part of the country.
The first 2 weeks in October, I'll be back.
Yeah, that's great. What about formal musical education?
Well, I studied these instruments in high school, and I majored in music theory in college.
Mm-hmm.
And then after I moved to New York, I studied piano with several really fine teachers. I had many sessions with Leonard Bernstein before he became a conductor, when he was undoubtedly headed to be the number one young concert pianist in America. And then, of course, he went with the came to Boston under Koussevitzky, and then he got interested in being a conductor then. So I had many sessions with him. Another woman teacher, Mrs. Nadia Reisenberg, was very influential. I studied with her during the 1940s, I guess, and she was a pupil of Salati in old Petrograd, Russia, and Salati was a teacher of Rachmaninoff on the keyboard. Then I studied a great deal with a man from Indiana, but who had been trained in England in a very novel system of playing the piano, a relaxation method that was evolved around 1900. So I studied quite a bit with him, and I'm sort of with that method now to play jazz. It transfers over to the way my ideas of jazz, much more than the other schools mm-hmm. of classical playing.
When you first got to Chicago, as I understand it, it was in the early 30s, and well, there you got along with people like Louis Armstrong that you mentioned here and Jimmy Noon, and you joined Benny Carter from there as your next step in 1933. So you must have been a gifted musician even at that point, Teddy, because this was pretty good company you were in.
Yes, I moved to New York to play for Benny Carter.
One of the most versatile musicians of all time.
Mm-hmm. He's probably one of the greatest talents of all. Yeah. Yet he plays all the instruments well, and not only that, he writes excellent background music for movies, and even these detective story television shows, he writes those backgrounds. He composes and arranges and conducts for people like Ella Fitzgerald when they use a big band, Peggy Lee, many of the big-name singers he writes for and conducts the band.
And then a little bit later on, after your... After your contact with Benny Carter in New York, you began to attract international jazz attention on a record which was supervised by John Hammond. This was when he listened to you with Carter's band. John Hammond was very influential in your career, wasn't he?
Yes, a very important man. I think John Hammond probably had more influence on the jazz movement than any other person who doesn't play an instrument.
Mm-hmm.
It's a non-profit thing with him. He's a very wealthy man, and years ago he... put me in contact with Billie Holiday. He set up the very first Benny Goodman Trio recording session in 1934. He introduced me to Mildred Bailey, Red Norvo, who were graduates of the Paul Whiteman Band, and each of them were very famous in those days on their own. And I played on a great many of Mildred Bailey's recordings, and Red would be her musical director, of course. And at their home... they had a party where I met Benny Goodman. John Hammond was present and set up this original Benny Goodman Trio date in 1934. Then a year or so later, Benny Goodman became a band leader. He got a commercial radio broadcast for National Biscuit Company and kept the band together after the program went off there. And also, John Hammond introduced me to Billie Holiday. He was familiar with her singing before I was. So he took me to a little club where she was singing, and I liked her singing, so he set up with Columbia some dates where I would organize the 6-7-piece bands, and Billy would be the singer.
As I've read stories of that party at Mildred Bailey's house, Mrs. Red Norvo, and Red was there too, of course, it was just a thing where you happened to sit down at the piano, and the next thing you know, Benny was putting the clarinet together, and they say that this is the way the trio got started. Was
That's
it
true.
All absolutely accidental?
That's true, yeah. I met Goodman at their home, that party, right. There was no bass there and no drum. Mildred had a cousin, Carl Bellinger, who had maybe got some whisk brooms and played a little drums on a chair or something like that. But Carl had a very interesting job. He was a test pilot for the Air Force. He tests the new warplanes before they would go into use.
That's a little more dangerous than playing piano or drums.
So he's never been a professional drummer, so John and Benny decided that Gene Krupa would be the ideal drummer for this recording session.
How did you feel about Krupa? I was so impressed with him when I met the man. He was much more of a gentleman than I ever expected.
He was one of the nicest people in the world, Gene Krupa. And wonderful to play with. I think some of the best playing I ever did was with him on the drums. And because we played together so long, we played together 3 consecutive years, steadily, night after night, and then... on many other occasions after that, too.
We're going to listen to one of the trio things. This was not one of the first sides. It was one of the first sides. I would say it was probably about 7th of all the trio recordings. Do you remember making China Boy in 1936?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. When did the trio become a quartet? How did Lionel Hampton get added to the group?
In the summer of 1937. See, I joined the group in Chicago. Benny was having Sunday afternoon jazz concerts at the Congress Hotel and having different guests every Sunday, and he asked me to come out from New York. I was working at the old famous store then, playing the intermissions there, and Bunny Berrigan had a small group in there, quartet, and I came out to be Benny's guest on Easter Sunday, and he asked me to stay on. And I contacted the famous door, and it was agreeable with them for me to leave with no notice. And I just stayed with the Goodman outfit for 3 years. And he already had an excellent pianist in his band, Jess Stacy, so he didn't replace Stacy with me. I only played with Krupa and Goodman. That's 1936. And then 1937, we were playing the Palomar Ballroom in Los Angeles. And we heard Lionel Hampton at a little club down on Central Avenue, I believe, or Main Street, some place there, and from that trip to Los Angeles in 1937, Goodman hired Lionel and to join the trio and make a quartet, hired Harry James on trumpet to join the big band, Vito Musso to join the reed section of the big band, all from California that summer of 37. Well, all of those dates were that way. The very first date we had in the band, Benny Goodman on clarinet, Ben Webster on tenor sax, Roy Elridge on trumpet, Cozy Cole on drums, John Kirby on bass, and John Trueheart on guitar, who was the guitarist with the Chick Webb band at that time. Mm-hmm. So those record dates were very unique, and they were truly all stars. Every man in these little bands, he was the best in his own band.
Yeah.
And these bands could not be put together. The payroll could not be met for these all-star groups to perform in public. But each one of these men was the number one man in his own band. But here in these recording sessions with Billie Holiday, he was surrounded with guys who were just as good as he was.
Yeah.
So it made for a very exciting and happy thing for each player to play with his own peers and try to please the others. And the money became secondary.
I'm so happy we
really
have
jazz played for pleasure by expert musicians.
They own the recording mechanism at that
mm-hmm.
time.
Right. The only way you could get those groups together would be at a recording session.
What was your contact with Billie? What kind of a person was she?
Well, she was a very lovely person when I was around her when we were doing these recordings. So these are very exciting occasions. We all look forward to these things. You see, each personnel was never exactly the same very often, because I would get on the phone and call the top men who were available in New York at the time. Maybe if Ellington was on the road, we'd use some of bassist men. Lester Young did a great amount of those recordings, and Buck Clayton did a lot. Joe Jones, bassist drummer at that time, and Walter Page, bassist guitarist. Al Casey did a lot of the guitar, Freddie Green, Dave Barber, who later married Peggy Lee, was on a lot of the guitar, Alan Roos from the Goodman Band on guitar.
Al Casey, goes back a few years. He used to play. He was one of the premier sidemen with Fats Waller, of course.
He worked with Fats, and he was with my big band, 1939. He was my guitar player. Yeah.
I got to put you on the spot a little bit now. You work a lot with Billie Holiday. You also work a great deal with Mildred Bailey. How would you compare them?
Oh, each had their own individual style. Each singer could sing for 5 seconds. The name was written all over music.
Yeah.
Great stylists, both. Especially Billie Holiday was maybe sounded more different from any other singer than any girl singer I had heard at that time. I had never heard a sound just like that. It was sincere. It was the way Billie was. It was just like singing was an extension of Billie Holiday.
That's right.
And I think Mildred was the same way. All the great singers. Ella Fitzgerald did some of those dates with us before she was famous, too, those small band dates.
You put together a fairly good band here, April 2nd of 1940 for a recording. Actually, it says Mildred Bailey and her orchestra. Would that have been set up perhaps by her husband, Red Norville, or by someone like you, or did she actually have her own band at that point?
No, she was not. She didn't lead a band. She was a soloist, and she recorded. It was popular to say Mildred Bailey and her orchestra, like you find a lot of the Billie Holiday sides, said Billie Holiday and her orchestra.
That's right, yes.
But Billie didn't carry an orchestra with her.
One that I want to play, Teddy, is called I'm Nobody's Baby. Eddie Sauter arranged it. You had Roy Eldridge on trumpet, among others, Eddie Powell on flute. Mitch Miller played oboe on this recording. Teddy Wilson, piano. John Collins, guitar. Pete Peterson, bass, and so on. Tremendous recording of I'm Nobody's Baby.
Now, those dates, Red Norwood would organize a band for those dates of Mildred's.
But not play.
No, I don't think he played on many to mount anything. He'd get the band together, and Mildred was especially fond of Eddie's writing, his arranging, and there's another finer writer, the fellow who wrote It's So Peaceful in the Country and Give Me Time, Alec Wilder.
Oh.
He did a lot of the arranging for Mildred in those days, too.
Yeah.
She liked his music. Oh. She recorded a lot of his original music, and he did the arrangements himself, too.
I'll bet some of his was dreamy, almost ethereal. Yeah, that would be his style.
Not so rhythmic as Eddie Sauter.
Uh-huh. There's another one called Lover Come Back to Me that says Mildred Bailey with Ellis Larkins conducting. Do you remember that?
No. See, Ellis is a very fine pianist. As a matter of fact, Ellis and I are going to tour South America in August with along with Mary McPartland and Earl Hines. We'll have four piano concert tour of South America. But I don't recall that particular record.
Well, we're going to play it and remind you right now.
Uh-huh. Oh, of course.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
What was the reaction? Was it, did Benny make a big deal of it or anyone else? Did the audience
react? No, I think the thing was so successful that a lot of the early people who tried to persuade Goodman not to get into it, I heard a rumor that some businessmen were telling him he was ruining his career and the public would not accept it. But it became a tremendous success.
Benny, in a conversation that I had with him, said I was simply trying to hire the best musicians I could for every job, and
that's
the
right.
color didn't make any difference.
That's right. He wasn't color conscious because the Goodman Band, the composition of the band, was the whole practice of the whole earth. They were Irish, fellows with Irish background, Jewish, everything you can think of in the Goodman Band.
It had to be one of the great thrills of your career when you appeared on that day in 1938 on the stage of Carnegie Hall, January 16th, 1938. For the first exclusive jazz concert by any great jazz band on that hallowed stage.
Mm-hmm. That's my impression of it, that we were the first all-jazz concert. Prior to that, there had been a Spirituals to Swing concert in which the Count Basie Band was featured and
right.
the Golden Gate Quartet.
But
I think that was the first all-jazz band concert.
Were you all pretty nervous about it that night?
No, it was just exciting that it was such a special occasion. But the Goodman Band played like that every night.
Mm-hmm.
Then the recording of that thing captured the feeling of much better than the studio recordings. But that band played like that every night, whether it's in Oklahoma or California or Carnegie Hall. It's a great jazz band.
Benny, of course, was apprehensive. He wanted to put a couple of comedy things on the bill and so on, just in case the music didn't go over. He wanted something else there just to fall back on. But I guess it turned out to be unnecessary.
I didn't know that. But what he did have extra was an excellent group of musicians from Ellington and
Basie
for the jam session.
That's right.
Honeysuckle Rose. That was. But there was no comedians or anything like that.
No,
it was just the Goodman outfit and the... these guests from Basie and Ellington for the big jam session.
It was just a great night for music.
Mm-hmm, it really was.
It's a shame that was done in the days before television. That's something we would have all been able to share in. Some of the other things you did with Benny Goodman, can I pick a couple of favorites and go ahead and play them here? For example, Slip Disc, which I think is a classic recording.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand that came about at a time that Benny was having some back troubles, and thus the name.
Benny had just come from the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, for an operation that cured his slip disc. And so we call that tune Slip Disc. And it's really, underneath Slip Disc, you'll find Jeepers Creepers and the King Porter Stomp structure mixed up together in little segments.
Before you would record something like this, or even before you'd play it on a live date, let's say it's a radio broadcast from one of your concerts, it might have been at one of your locations here, it might have been on the stage of the State Theater here in Hartford, what would you do, especially in your small group recordings? Would you go through a framework, or was everything that you did completely ad-libbed?
No, these things, we spent hours and hours of rehearsal on these little things till we'd put these arrangements together without music. And Slip Disc, for instance, Red Norvo contributed ideas, I contributed ideas, Goodman contributed ideas, but Goodman will have the final say on putting the thing together.
Mm-hmm.
So say, like, we need an interlude, or we need an introduction, we need an ending, and everybody would come up with ideas, and Goodman would select what he thought was the most appropriate in putting the little arrangements together. But we spent hours, many hours, rehearsing these things.
Isn't that interesting?
We'd memorized our parts, because there's quite a bit of a three-way ensemble in there between the vibraphone, clarinet, and piano, in which we had to... Work it out, the melodic part, and then the harmonic parts had to be worked out, and everyone memorized his part. This took many hours of work.
That's very true. I'm thinking of things like Rachel's Dream.
Yes.
I think that it was clarinet, vibes, and piano, down the line. Mm-hmm. And that, I'm sure,
that's
had to
same,
be rehearsed.
Same group that made their,
Slip disc,
yeah. Red Novel was in there, Rachel's Dream. And then some of the earlier things with Lionel Hampton, too, we rehearsed, like Dizzy Spells and Handful of Keys. A lot of those arrangements were rehearsed many hours to get the final product.
Of course, you were chosen to appear with a great many all-star groups over the years, and this is something that used to be a tremendous honor. But I'm thinking back particularly to the year 1946. It's one of my favorite all-star groups. All-star groups always struck me, Teddy, that too often... a bunch of gifted musicians would get together, and without really having too much rehearsal time, it almost sounded like every man for himself. And I didn't get that impression with this group of 1946 award winners, of which you were very definitely a part. Let's see, the whole lineup had Charlie Shavers and Buck Clayton on trumpets, J.J. Johnson trombone, Coleman Hawkins on tenor sax, and we could write a book about Coleman Hawkins, too, couldn't we?
Let's see, would that be J.C. Higginbottom on trombone?
No.
Would that be an Esquire?
This is Esquire's All America, yeah.
They have J.J. Johnson?
They have J.J. Johnson, and it should be J.C. Higginbottom?
Let me see.
How about that?
Look, they have Shadow Wilson on drums. But maybe I'm thinking about it. Maybe that's correct. Maybe I'm thinking about a different year.
Mm-hmm.
All-star thing.
John Collins on guitar, and Chubby Jackson on bass, Harry Carney on baritone saxophone. It's a marvelous group.
They're probably right. I'm probably wrong then. No, this is not a big jam session. No, this is
more worked out. It's a number called "Blow Me Down."
No, I never got into the bop movement. I thought it would not be wise for me to get into that.
Yeah,
because it would wind up. I'd already established my own style, and it was known from recordings. And for me to change would indicate I would be trailing after what. See, the whole bop movement is Charlie Parker, meaning becoming a copy of Charlie Parker. So I thought that would not be wise.
Yeah.
I better stay with what I was doing and just refine it and keep it up to a certain standard.
How did it feel to work with a great professional like Ella Fitzgerald? What a great vocalist.
You know, she's a tremendous talent. Only in those days, Ella was not famous. That was the beginning of her career when she sang on that record date.
This is just about the time she was recording with Chick Webb at Tisket
Tasket. She was with Chick Webb. Then. Uh-huh. This would probably be before Tisket Tasket.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, right.
Because that was a very big record for her, and Stairway to the Stars. I think this, The Melancholy Baby, and All My Life she did.
Right. March 17th.
It's All My Life they have here. Yeah.
And My Melancholy Baby also. Yeah. A couple of great numbers from a very, very young Ella Fitzgerald.
Yeah.
When you got around to forming your own orchestra, how did you go about picking musicians? You'd work with all the great ones, so you knew
who
you wanted.
Well, in touring with Goodman, I had come in contact on the road with a lot of players that I liked very much. I got three or four men from Detroit for my own big band in 1939 after I left the Goodman Band. And I got my main arranger, Buster Harding, was from Buffalo. I got... Harold Baker, who would come in from St. Louis and to play for Don Redman's band. And that band, I think, sort of broke up, and he was all set to go back to St. Louis, and I got him for my big band. And so, like that, and various players who were available around New York that I thought would fit in with what I was trying to do.
What years did you have your band together, Ted?
That big band lasted... about a year and a half, I guess. I think we made about 20 sides for Columbia. And then I cut down to, I got offered this year-round engagement at the Cafe Society with a small group, and I let the big band go because it was losing money for me. And then I began losing my men. Ben Webster, my feature saxophone player, went with Duke Ellington, and that was quite a loss out of my reed section. And we weren't doing very much with money jobs anyway. The the booking office, Music Corporation, was using it sort of like a football, letting promoters make money back on us that they had lost on other MCA attractions. So so I took the job, the steady thing at the Cafe Societies with the small group, which lasted all during the Second World War.
I look back at my copy of The Big Bands with George T. Simon, and he says some marvelous things about your band. He says it featured some of the top musicians of the time. Its style was very polite, like Teddy himself, but polite black bands were difficult to sell in those days. And he feels that that perhaps is the reason that the band didn't come on and capture quite the attention that he felt it deserved.
Yeah, we didn't last long enough to get some really good, exciting jazz, enough good, exciting jazz arrangements going, which in those days, the best ones just take time, like the Goodman version of Sing, Sing, Sing took months and months before that final version was formed, playing it every night. The majority of it wasn't written. Only a little bit of that thing was written. But the musicians playing a song night after night developed ideas on the order of the Goodman Quartet and the small groups.
I didn't realize
so
that.
So my big band didn't stay together long enough. We were rather weak on the fiery type of arrangements, which you put together what we call a head arrangement, not written.
I want to play something else here from Teddy Wilson's orchestra. It's called The Hour of Parting. Do you remember this? It says Benny Goodman sat in for a few sessions with the wonderful Teddy Wilson pickup groups of the middle and late 30s. Here he joins Goodman's sidemen Teddy Wilson, Harry James on trumpet, Vito Musso on tenor, Alan Roos guitar, Brother Harry on bass, and Gene Krupa on drums. The singer, one of the best of the day and now all but forgotten. Do you remember the singer's name? The Hour of Parting? It's a name I've never heard till now. Boots Castle.
Boots Castle, yes.
Was Boots a pretty good vocalist?
Yes. I never heard of her after that, though. I believe that was recorded in California, I think.
And here's another one called You Came to My Rescue, an excellent tune from Big Broadcast of 1937, which bears reviving, it says. Same personnel as in The Hour of Parting, except that Goodman trumpeter Chris Griffin replaces Harry James and Lionel Hampton is added on vibes, and one of Helen Ward's best vocals, though the original issue playing the pseudonym game again listed her as Vera Lane. It actually was Helen Ward. Do you remember this?
Yes.
One?
That would be, I believe, New York, that recording. I'm not sure.
Gee, you've recorded probably with every great vocalist of the past two or three generations.
Quite a few.
Have you ever planned on writing a book, Teddy?
Yes.
Are you going to work on one?
Yes. I already have about 6 hours of interview, like what we're doing, done by the Danish radio, which I'm having taken off the tape and put down on paper. So we'll have something to start with there and add pertinent facts that are not included on these tapes.
To make
a book.
Such an integral part of all this. I would hate to think of you staying so busy playing the piano you didn't get around to putting it all on paper. We'd love to read about it. We have another one here called Warming Up. This is one that you composed as well. Your band recorded it May 14th of 1936. Again, it's another of those groups that where you picked up such super musicians. Roy Eldridge on trumpet, Buster Bailey clarinet, Teddy Wilson piano, Bob Lessie guitar, Israel Crosby bass, Sid Catlett on drums, and another reed man that I admired so very much, and another one who was cut down early in his life, Chu Berry on tenor.
Yes.
That was a good
session. And of course, that warming up is just an improvisation based on some standard tune of the day, maybe something like I Found a New Baby, without using the Found a New Baby melody. Every man makes his own melody. But the foundation of it would have been some standard song.
One of the great discussions in jazz during that time and for a while beyond that was the discussion of who was the greater of the tenor men, Chu Berry or Coleman Hawkins. I guess everybody agrees they were sort of 1-2, and I think the consensus would appear to be Coleman Hawkins as the greatest. But I, for one, preferred Chu Berry. How did you feel about them?
I think I liked Hawkins a shade better, but Chu was a very fine player. I think Coleman Hawkins and the most important historically. I think he was more imitated around the world, you know, like Louis Armstrong and Ellington with written music. Ellington with the written music, Louis Armstrong with the trumpet, Coleman Hawkins with the tenor sax, and later Lester Young with the tenor sax, and then Charlie Parker with the alto sax.
The bird.
I think Coleman would have been much stronger influence than Chu.
Much more influential, yeah.
But Chu was a very fine player, tremendous tenor player.
And, of course, he was cut down a lot sooner and didn't have quite the time to make the contribution that Coleman
did. Right, there's no telling where he would wound up. He killed an automobile accident and he's still in his 20s.
Yes, but he left a great legacy of records again.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Have you ever regretted that you got into the music business, Teddy?
No, this is making money at a hobby.
Oh, I think that says it awfully well. You've worked with all of the greats ever since, well, about it's about 45 years now. You've worked with every great name in jazz, instrumental and vocal. I imagine you have some marvelous memories of all this. Are there some special favorite stories that you have about any of the people you've worked with?
No, nothing too special. It's mostly all the time it's doing a job that we all enjoy doing, and it's a pleasure to go to work. It's not like having a job where you hate to go. It's fun to play this kind of music.
When you're making appearances like the one at the Tobacco Valley Inn, how much work do you do in arranging what you're going to play? Do you sit there with kind of a list of the things you're going to play?
No. Some nights the requests start coming in. Someone will send up a note with a request, and then in a few minutes there's many more that guide me, and I'll just play the request. But without the request, I generally tend to group my pieces. Sometimes I'll play a whole set of Ellington, whole set of Gershwin, a whole lot of Fats Waller. And then sometimes I play songs that I recorded with Billie Holiday, with different songwriters, and then sometimes I played some of the tunes we featured with the Benny Goodman Quartet and Trio in a group, and that's what sort of reminds me how to program the things to put them together that way. Those three different formats I use, and then sometimes I just play a medley of old tunes from the 1930s, or sometimes play a lot of Richard Rodgers songs in a row, or Cole Porter songs.
It's fantastic that you sit there and remember tunes by the hundred. How much longer is Teddy Wilson going to keep playing?
No, I can't retire. I can't afford it.
We can't afford to let you retire, Teddy. And therein lies this story. I hope you'll keep going for a long time and always enjoy it as much as you obviously enjoy it right now.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. Somebody, say for instance, give you an example. Say I played Body and Soul twice last night, and Body and Soul came out around 1929. I must have played it 100,000 times. And the question arises, how can you play the same piece 100,000 times? Because of this approach to music, the object is not to repeat yourself unless you have to. You're always trying to invent a little pattern that you haven't played in a certain little situation before. Or either put old patterns together in new, like put in a chain together, put the links in different places. So you never played exactly the same way twice.
That's wonderful.
So that's what keeps you interested, and you can play the same pieces year in and year out, because the object is, as I said, not to repeat yourself.
It's
always a challenge. Challenge.
You have the same enthusiasm, Teddy, as somebody 40 years your junior just entering the music business, and I think that says a lot.
Mm-hmm.
That's marvelous.
A lot of the new jazz nowadays is where the harmony is very simple, where a player tries to, with very, very simple harmony, maybe one or two chords, to play for 1/2 hour and keep it interesting, be inventing. That's one of this new trend in jazz nowadays. It's not easy, but it's quite a challenge. It's a lot of fun to try to do, but for the listener to sit through it, it's not easy a lot of times. But it is a lot of fun to try to play that way. We had a man come to New York from Chicago during the Second World War named Robert Crumb, and he went even farther. Every time he sat at the piano, he would create. He never played a song, but he tried to create a composition every time he sat down. And and he was amazingly successful at times. Not always, but sometimes some mighty good stuff did come out of the piano from him. He died a very young man, unfortunately, too.
This kind of brings us to
trying not to repeat yourself is the secret of keeping you interested in jazz. Because I don't play original music. I don't amount to anything. I play other people's music, but I try to embroider around it differently every time. Never the same twice.
Did you have a favorite composer?
No, these are all my favorites. I've switched from Fats to Duke Ellington to Gershwin and Cole Porter, Richard Rodgers. And, you
And Duke Kelly.
All the good ones. Yeah, Duke, of course. Yeah.
Teddy, I know you've had a really exhausting schedule in the time you've been in the area, and you've given us a whole hour of your time, and I appreciate it sincerely, and we're looking forward to having you back, and I hope business will always be as great for you as it is here right now.
Thank you, Arnold. I sure have enjoyed talking to you.